Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm and author of Investing Simplified, the book. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial show in America, with a financial advisor, an estate planning attorney, and a CPA to answer your questions for free, and is broadcast live from Portland, Oregon on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck with a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com. Or you can call him right now at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. Or for our long distance and podcast listeners, you can call toll free at 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
Welcome to Investing Simplified. We've got a great show this morning, and we've got Harry Dent, economist, author, on the line that we're going to be talking to here real quick. I just want to give a quick update here. If you have a question for Harry Dent and you'd like to ask Harry Dent a question, pick up the phone, call 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. And if you're long distance or listening to us on a webcast, at the number, the toll-free number is 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. And with no further ado, I'm going to introduce Harry Dent. Harry, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, how's the weather in Tampa?
Oh, it's been almost perfect recently.
Hey, how are the sign-ups going for the next year Rational Economic Conference?
Well, last I heard, they've been going great.
Yeah, I'd gotten a memo saying that you better get signed up for it because they're going to fill up.
Yeah, no, this one definitely will. And we've got Lacey Hunt back, who's one of our most popular speakers and the only traditional economist I really like. And we got David Walker for the first time, and many others. So, yeah, no, it's definitely going to be good. And I think the most important on this one, I think it's going to be probably our most timely conference. I really feel like we're at a critical point where this kind of bubble getting ready to break now or in the next few months. So I think it's a really good time for people to reevaluate everything.
Well, and you couldn't have a better location to have it at either than in Florida. But listen, I'm signed up. I'm ready to go. So I'm excited about it. And I agree with you. I think Lacey Hunt is one of those jewels that you continue to have at your Irrational Economic Summit. And I'm just going to give a shout-out there to anybody that's not getting your newsletter that can sign up on my website or on your site. And if they're not getting that and they're not looking at that information to go to this Economic Irrational Summit, you're just wasting your money buying anything else, because you can go live and hear some of the top minds in the world talk about economics. And especially listening to you, Harry.
Yeah. No, it's really, it just forces people just to really get real. I've had actually some people I know here in Tampa and some friends go, you know, and, you know, they hear me talking, you know, with lunch or dinner or whatever and stuff. But to come to the conference, they're like, oh, now I get it. You know, they're like, oh, now I see. It takes that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think once you go to one, you're not going to want to miss the next one. It's almost like a drug. You always joke that the economy is kind of on crack, but I think when people go to your economic summit, it's the same kind of thing. They kind of get addicted to it because there's so much going on. There's so much knowledge to get. You want to go back the next time.
Yeah, there's good and bad addictions. Like, you know, oxygen, that's a good addiction.
Yeah. 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 Well, listen, I want to get right into a couple of things that I think, looking at this economic scene, what's going on in the economy right now, We keep hearing mixed things when the president comes out and talks about the great job of unemployment and that it's now down below 5%. And yet so many of us know so many people who are out of work.
I mean, what everybody ignores is the fact that we went from, I think, 67% labor force participation down to 62%, the lowest it's been in decades, or, gosh, even more than decades. I mean, a lot of people just kind of gave up. And also, it's part of our demographic story. I've been warning people for years is that it's not just the people that will retire at age 62 to 65, and it is about 63 on average. People start leaving the workforce, second earners, you know, in their 50s when their kids get out of college and they realize, my gosh, we don't both have to work anymore. So one of the workers, more typically the woman, will say, well, you know what? I'm going to quit my job and maybe I'll do some part-time work or maybe I'll do something out of my home. But yeah, we don't need to both work full-time. Now we got Susie and Johnny through college and you know, mortgaged our future. So that's another thing, but part of it is, hey, the jobs just aren't that good. One of the things David Stockman looked at our last IES conference was, you know, folks, look at the jobs. You can count numbers of jobs, but the quality of jobs are hugely different. He said, you know, there's the breadwinner jobs, and then there's the bellhop jobs, or whatever he calls them, and then there's the manufacturing in the middle, and basically, we're not creating many of the good jobs, and we're creating a lot of these, you know, minimum wage or slightly above minimum wage jobs, and a lot of them are part-time. So if somebody's looking at that, and instead they can go on disability or welfare or something else, or just kick back and make some money on the side, why would they, you know, work hard for minimum wage when there aren't better jobs available? So, yeah, if you adjust for that, the people who would like to be employed or would like to be full-time and are part-time, what we call underemployment, then the unemployment rate is still not that far off the 12% that hit way back. You know, that's probably still more like 10 or 11%. So, it's not as good as it looks. But, I mean, we have, because of all this stimulus, we have created more jobs than would be normal from the natural workforce trends, because we can measure that, you know. People enter the workforce at age 20 on average, and they exit at 63. Another thing we can project decades in the future, and we're going to get to a point where more people are leaving than entering, and that's very deflationary, by the way, and that's another cause of deflation. But right now, the stimulus is adding. I mean, but we're mainly adding back jobs that were lost in the recession. We're just getting back to kind of even. And instead of growing, we've seen workforce participation go down, and it just doesn't look like it's going to come back. I don't expect it to come back, even if the economy holds up, and I don't expect the economy to hold up, obviously.
Well, you know, Harry, one of the concerns I have is that, and we've talked about it on our show, and we've talked about it with you in the past, is that if you go back the last 6 years, the average family is making less money today than they were 6 years ago, and that's scary.
In fact, if you adjust for inflation, the average family is making less money than 2000, 16 years ago, and they're barely making more than they made in the 70s at the heyday of the middle class. So that's why you've got all these on both sides, angry Trump voters and angry Bernie Sanders voters, because you got the whole middle of our economy is making little or no progress or even going backwards or going on disability or just leaving the workforce and giving up and retiring early. So, you know, it's not a good sign. And, you know, everybody wants everybody to feel good. But, I mean, I tell you, the worst thing I saw, I just did an issue of one of our newsletters, and it's focusing on the middle class and how it is the worst in the world in the United States. Our middle class is only like 37% of our economy. It used to be over 60. And that middle class's share of the total wealth in this country, including people's personal residences, which is the biggest part of it for most people, is only 19.6%. It's the lowest in the world. Most other European and East Asian countries are between 40 and 50%. Australia is over 60%. So, I mean, you can see why our middle class is the most angry. They've been hit by the income inequality of the rich doing so well on the upside, far more than in Europe and East Asia. And on the lower side, they've been hit by the loss of jobs to Asia. I call it the Asian deflation, who's pushed wages down in manufacturing machine, and Mexico's competing with us in manufacturing, and the immigrants that come in legally and illegally. And that's exactly the issues, you know, Bernie saying, let's break up Wall Street, and Trump saying, let's stop immigration and loss of jobs overseas.
Well, did you ever think that you would see a socialist, I mean, a right-out socialist running for president and being on the cusp of maybe winning one of the political parties and running for president?
Well, you know, actually, Chuck, I would have seen that because we've got this four-season model, and the Republicans, and let's call it the capitalists, do best in the what I call the summer and fall seasons. And then the Democrats, or the more socialists, do better in the winter and spring season. So the winter seasons in the past would have been the Great Depression and then the boom of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. But from the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and up to now, the Republicans and the capitalists have done better. But so it goes to one extreme or the other. And when capitalism gets too far and the rich get too rich and the special interests take over like they have today, and the wealthy, I mean, the top 1% are garnering 50% of the wealth and 20-some percent of the income and spending, then it's like people, it goes the other way. You can't keep going in that direction. You can't have the generals with no troops, you know?
Well, you know, Harry, though, one of the things that I've seen lately in the government, when you see some of the salaries that some of these government officials are making,
oh yeah,
it's way out of whack of what you make in the public market.
No, it isn't. And I tell you, on top of that, it's worse than that because almost all public officials, including local and regional and state, they don't pay for anything. If somebody's always buying their golf game, buying their dinner, buying their wine, sending them presents, taking them on boat trips, so they get income that you don't see from all this stuff because everybody's trying to, you know, basically bribe them.
Well, all of us in the securities and the insurance industry, those days are gone in our industry now because of the reporting, and you can't do that kind of stuff anymore in our industry.
Yeah, that's right, and you know that's going to happen more in government and stuff too. But you know, right now, I mean, we're at a really big tipping point, the biggest tipping point in a lifetime of a consumer, or on our 80-year four-season cycle that we have. Is when you switch from the fall bubble boom season, and fall is always a bubble boom because it's when technologies are strongest and the economy's strongest and demographics are strongest, but it's also when there's just constantly falling inflation and interest rates. And the more inflation and interest rates fall, the more people speculate. The better the economy does, the more people want to die and go to heaven and not work anymore. I mean, you saw that in the 90s. Everybody wanted to be a stock flipper working from home and quit their job. And then in the 2000s, everybody wanted to be a condo and house flipper and quit their job. And you can't have an economy where everybody's flipping stuff and nobody's producing anything or creating new businesses and stuff. Flipping, speculating does not add value to the economy. It just creates bubbles. And then when those bubbles burst, wealth suddenly disappears. And we've never even – I can't even go back in history unless I go back to the early 1700s or the actually early 1800s as well, the big Midwest expansion bubble, and see a bubble that even remotely compares to this. And this is totally global. There's bubbles everywhere and in everything. Commodities, now that they're crashing, no. I mean, they've crashed. Real estate everywhere, almost stocks everywhere. It's just bubble, bubble, bubble. Bubbles are not good for the economy. They just create imbalances. And what the central banks are doing around the world, which is the worst possible policy, is that they're saying, gosh, we can't afford this bubble to burst. Everybody will be bankrupt. We'll be in a Great Depression. We'll look like idiots. You know, and the prime minister or the president will look like idiots. So everybody's just trying to keep the bubble going as long as they can and hoping the next administration or the next central bank head will have to deal with the burst, because nobody, and I will promise you this 100%, nobody can keep a bubble going forever. And that's what they're trying to do. And the bubble would have naturally ended in late 2007. And we predicted that 20 years before it happened. And we started seeing the bubble unravel, especially in the United States and around the world, and stock market crashes everywhere and debt problems everywhere. And then they just cured it with crack. You know, they just pumped $12 trillion of quantitative easing in the economy and covered it over. They didn't change anything, didn't deleverage any significant debt. We've got $57 trillion more debt than we had in 2007, 2008, at the top of the last bubble. And most of that new debt came in emerging countries who are falling the hardest and fastest because commodity prices are collapsing, which we also predicted years ago on a 30-year cycle that works like a clock. So this stuff, people say, oh, who would think this? You know, and my biggest thing, Chuck, I hate it when economists say, oh, that was a black swan event. Hey, The tsunami hitting Japan, that's a black swan event. The Great Depression was not a black swan event. The collapse of Japan was not a black swan event. We predicted it totally in advance. This 2008 crash around the world was not a black swan event. And when we go down in the next two to four to five years, it's not going to be a black swan event at all. Debt bubbles burst. Demographic trends go up, and then they go down. When something like that happens, people just think, oh, who would have seen that coming? Well, they're not looking at the right indicators. They're looking at coincident and lagging indicators and saying, well, the economy's still growing 2% or jobs are still growing 200,000 a year. If you look at those indicators, you would have never seen the Japan collapse. Japan economy looked perfect in late 1989, just before it collapsed for now 26 years and can't get off its ass, even with 20 years of quantitative easing that they're now tripling down on. Well, I mean, what does that tell you? That is not a black swan event. There are certain things we can't see, but there's too many things economists consider black swan events that are not. They're black swan events because they don't understand what really drives the economy.
Well, one of the things I know here in the local area, we've got some news that this coming week, Intel's going to report a major layoff, and they just haven't decided how many thousands are going to lose their jobs.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs just is reporting layoffs, and other companies. I mean, retail sales keep going down. GDPs could be as low as 0.5% in the first quarter. How can the stock market keep going up? Earnings have been down. Now, this will be the third quarter of down earnings. Stock markets don't go up when earnings go down. The only time they do is when they're on crack. And when there's constant stimulus pumped in the economy and there's nowhere else for money to go, so people just hold their nose and buy stocks anyway. This is crazy.
It is. And I look at the 10-year Treasury's down below 2. It's 1.78.
Yeah, which means it's basically free money. I mean, you're getting zero adjusted for inflation. We've got a great chart that shows in the last 4 years, that with all this quantitative easing, the 10-year Treasury used to be 2%. Real yields when you adjusted for inflation, and we use 3-year average inflation since inflation is so volatile short term. Now it's zero, and in most countries in Europe and Japan, you're getting negative yields adjusted for inflation, substantially negative yields. This is crazy. Money should not be free. When money is free, it will be abused. The reason that money costs money is it's a force businesses and investors to make investments that will produce substantial enough returns. Economies cannot grow without investments that create new productive capacity and returns to investors and better jobs and wages. But when money's free, you can just speculate and do stuff that doesn't make sense. And that's exactly what businesses are doing. Most of the companies borrowing in corporate America are going to stock buybacks and mergers that just rearrange the pie and make it look better and don't change growth at all, don't change capacity at all. In fact, they may even cut back capacity and jobs. So this is we're living on crack, and you can do that for a while. I mean, how many people know drug addicts or alcoholics or crack addicts or whatever? They can go many years before it starts taking its toll, and then but at some point you're going to pass out and go into detox or die.
Well, you know, we've had a couple of deep dips here. Actually since May. We're actually negative in all three of the markets that we follow, the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ. They're all negative since May. And, of course, all you hear on the news is that year-to-date they're positive. But they're not that positive.
They'll find something to say, hey, they're up 100 points today. You know, well, yeah, but they were down 150 yesterday. The truth is stocks have gone nowhere since November 2014. We had that big crash in October 2014. one last big surge. Markets then barely went up to new highs into May, and since May, every rally has failed to make new highs. I think we're right at that precipice right now where we bounce strongly again. The market wants to go up because it's got nowhere else to go, nowhere else to put money, but we're hitting limits, and the news just isn't that good, and I think it's getting ready to head back down pretty soon. We're right at that point where it shouldn't go much higher. But the point is, the real point is, we're talking about the best markets in the world. The ones you just said, the S&P, the Dow, the NASDAQ, those are the only major markets in the world that have not gone into major bear markets, down 20, 25, 30, 35, 40% or more. Emerging markets have been creamed. Brazil's been creamed. China's down 50 recently. Small caps were down 27% recently. The best countries in Europe have been down 25% or more, Germany, France, all that sort of stuff. And the worst countries have been down 50, 60, 70%. I mean, everywhere else is in a bear market. These are the last markets, the best house in a bad neighborhood, the large caps that hold up the longest. But then they eventually collapse because the dumb money, when it comes in, the last investors to pile in will always buy the well-known large caps, Coca-Cola, Apple, Google, whatever, General Electric, because they don't know any better. The smart money buy smaller cap stocks where there's a huge disparity in values that you can sort through if you're sophisticated. So when you see the small caps underperforming the large caps, which we've seen in the last year very, very clearly, it's over. That's the sign of a major top. That happened in mid to late 2007, and it happened in late 2000. So to me, this thing is just waiting to go down.
One of the questions that I get asked all the time, and people are concerned about it, and of course there's a lot of different people out there talking today about the doom and gloom and the end of America as we know it, and one of the things people are always concerned and always ask me about, they ask me, do you think the banks could close and just hang on to our money, and kind of like what happened to Greece, all of a sudden have negative interest and we can't get our money.
Well, I mean, it's kind of what happened in the Great Depression. What really happens is banks lend money against your deposits. Now, remember, they're your deposits, but they use them as collateral as if they're their deposit, and they can lend out as much as 10 to 1. They only have to hold 10% reserves, and they only tend to have about 10% capital reserves. So if they lose enough, if they lose 20, 30, 40% or more in their loans because mortgages are failing and corporate loans are failing and business loans and stuff, then they don't really have your money. And that's why there were runs on the bank. People started saying, uh-oh, they don't seem to have our money, so everybody stands in line to get it, and the banks just run out, and they can't pay everybody. So this is probably going to happen. And the government say, well, now we have deposit insurance. There's no government that can guarantee all the deposits in their country and all the more. They've guaranteed most of the mortgages, and they stand behind financial institutions' business. This can't be done.
Well,
it only happens if you have a minor disaster. Well, we built up a major bubble, and when this one cracks, my view, Chuck, has been very consistent on this. Governments keep cranking up. There is no limit to it. They will go higher and higher. They'll keep doubling down, but the bubble will break at a point, and when it does, it's going to be so stretched, it will be much quicker, much harder downturn, and people will panic faster because it won't be like they're thinking, oh, well, this happened in the Great Depression. They're like, oh, crap, this happened in 2008, and now it looks worse. People will run. They will sell stocks. You know, they'll panic on their houses or whatever much faster. So I'm telling people, and who was it, Baron Rothschild said, when somebody said, you know, what's the secret to your great wealth? And he says, well, you know, I always sold a little early. That's what I'm telling people. When bubbles burst, they burst 2 to 3 times as fast. And again, we just saw China in 2.5 months. Their first bubble burst saw 45% drop in 2.5 months. Now it's bounced a little bit, but not much, and it's going to crack again this year, no question about it. In 1929, when the great Dow bubble burst, first 2.5 months down 42%. So if you wait for evidence and you say, well, why don't I hold on? I'm still earning a little bit, or stocks may still go up. It's foolish to hang in at this point. Get out. The best of the bubble's over. We've gone nowhere for 1.5 years. That's a hint. And I think I call this a rounded top. I put this kind of rounded top on the market from late 2014 through now, with May as the top. And we're right at that point where the market should fail, you know, within a, like a percent of here possibly. It's just the wrong time to be in the markets. And I tell people, even if we do manage to go up and eke one more slight new high, okay, you got a 5 to 10% upside. If I'm right and we see a next collapse larger than the last one, which is what this megaphone higher highs and higher lows would strongly suggest, then you got a 65, 70% downside. I'm not going to hold on to an investment with a 5 to 10% upside when the downside, I'm not talking 10 years from now, I'm talking a year and a half from now, is 65% or more. That is just bad investing.
Yeah, you're gambling with your future.
Really gambling. And people say, yeah, but I need this, and I can't get any yield. I can only get 2% on the treasury bond. I'm like, take the 2% on the treasury bond. Don't even buy, or take a AAA corporate bond, maybe at 3, 3.5%. Do not buy a high-yield bond. Do not buy stocks just because they're paying 3% dividend. That 3% dividend will not look like a bargain when even the best stocks, and I went back to the Great Depression, the best stocks dropped 50 to 60%, the worst 90+. But even the best stocks drop because fear sets in and the price-to-earnings ratio, the valuations of stocks, even if their earnings hold up, their stock can still go down 50% just because valuations go from 20 times price earnings to 8. And that's typically what happens.
Well, you know, one of the things that concerned me is when you look at everything being in technology and the fact that the NASDAQ, when the NASDAQ crashed in March of 2000, it didn't recover until 2015.
Exactly. And same thing, Chuck. That first wave down in the most bubbly market was 40-some percent in the first couple of months.
Yeah.
So if you waited and then panicked when it went down that much, then you already lost half of what you were going to lose in 2.5 months. Yeah, it took 2.5 years for the NASDAQ to lose, 70%, and the Dow it took almost 3 years to lose 89%. But half of those losses came in the first couple of months. So you're playing with fire here.
Well, I constantly send out on my newsletter, I send a copy of your megaphone graph, and I tell people, I said, look, the first two took 4.5 to 5.5 years to recover. The next one's going to be deeper and wider. It's going to take 7 to 9 years recovery. It's not going to be a 4-year recovery.
And I'm going to give you worse than that, Chuck. Because the demographics long-term are so slow, I'm talking out decades. And since the major tops, like 29 and 68, adjusted for inflation and stock, those tops took 23 to 25 years to get back to where they were because they fell so far and took so long to turn around. This is not another like, okay, we're going to have a year or two recession and then bounce back. No, this is going to be several years of down. The markets are going to be, and the typical correction in a bubble burst like this, and people look at me like I'm crazy, and I'm like, well, wait a minute. It already happened in Japan. It's already happened in commodities. 80% is typical when a major long-term top, especially when it's bubble, bursts. That's not off the charts. That's not a black swan event. That's exactly what you should expect from looking at history. So I think stocks are going to go down to 3 to 6,000 on the Dow over the next several years. And I think by 2036, in the next boom, and we're talking 20 years from now, they'd be lucky to be back near the top at best. So this is a really, really bad time to buy stocks or to stay in stocks. This is a time where you can't listen to the traditional stockbroker. Their thing is asset allocation. You just diversify. Stocks always go higher. And so just stay in the market and ride it out. Hey, 9 out of 10 times, yes, I would agree with that. Now, no, this is the one time in your life, or actually two times, like the late 60s, early 70s, and now, or the late 20s, where you should not. You have to get out, and you have to let the crash happen, and then you can invest long-term again with asset allocation. But I'm telling people, this is the worst time in your lifetime to be in stocks, and it's going to be worse than being in stocks in late 2007.
And so you think this is even going to be worse than the 66 to 82 that you were talking about?
Yes, because that's what I call the summer season burst.
Yep.
know, you go from a boom in spring and then inflation, but you don't have the giant demographic slide, as big a demographic slide. And inflation is not as devastating as deflation. Deflation is like winter. It freezes everything over. It kills everything so that you can rise from the ashes again or to see what's going to survive. It's an unbelievable survival of the fittest test. And that's why asset allocation doesn't work in that one season. In the 70s, for example, our model would have said, hey, you don't want to be in stocks because stocks don't like inflation or declining demographics. You certainly don't want to be in bonds, even treasury bonds long term, because they hate inflation more than anybody. But you could have been in Japan, emerging countries, commodities, and real estate and short term bonds to keep up inflation, and it done fine. There is nowhere to go except the highest quality long-term bonds and the reserve currency, the strongest currencies like the dollar, which everybody thinks weak. They're wrong about that. That's the only place to go. Commodities have crashed. Gold will crash further. Real estate will crash more than anybody can imagine. Stocks are going to crash much lower than last time around and more globally. There's going to be nowhere to hide. And junk bonds are going to get absolutely crucified. So there's nowhere to diversify. You got high-quality bonds, short-term high-quality, long-term bonds, short-term high-quality bonds, and the U.S. dollar versus other currencies. That's the only places I see doing well in the next several years. Everything else is going to go down at one time or another and sharply. That's only the winter season. It only happens once in a lifetime, and that's why no economist, no stockbroker, and most investors, including Warren Buffett, are not going to see this coming. It's just not in there. It's not anything any of us has seen in our lifetime. If you got a grandfather 99 years old, he might see it coming. If he doesn't have dementia, you know. So it's just like nobody's going to see it coming.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about it for a couple of years now, and I think we're getting to a point where it's getting bubbling up pretty big right now. And one of the things that just bothers me about this country and about the world. How much debt can you just keep running up?
We've got statistics that show everybody's talking about deleveraging. Yeah, we deleveraged a little bit of mortgage debt. We deleveraged a little bit of financial leverage debt, which is the most toxic. But government debt is way higher. It was $10 trillion at the top of the last bubble. Now it's $19 trillion in rising. But globally, we added just as much debt between 2009 and now, globally, $57 trillion, as we did between 2000 and 2008 in the last bubble. We added 55. So we haven't not only deleveraged, we have levered up more than ever. And you're right. You just can't keep adding debt. You can't keep printing money out of thin air, putting it into the financial institutions with zero interest rates and free money where all they do is turn into a casino and keep speculating. Because, by the way, they're not making a whole lot of loans, if nobody's noticed. Why? Because businesses overexpanded in the last bubble. Consumers overexpanded and overborrowed and bought too big a house and everything. People don't need more credit. So all these financial institutions and investors are speculating, which adds nothing to the economy while the debt grows and the bubbles get worse. And then at some point it cracks and Humpty Dumpty falls off and breaks into pieces. And then it comes a point where you can't put it back together.
Well, Harry, we really appreciate your time. I'm going to do a little selling on your book and your newsletter when you leave the air. But we really appreciate your time and Rodney's each month. And we tell people on our Northwest Network here, we're on five stations. And we have a lot of listeners on the website. We send out over 1 million emails to people listening throughout the country. So hopefully a lot of people are hearing you and are going to take action. Because I'm going to give a little thing here on your newsletter and also on your book. And if people haven't read your book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019, there's never been a better day than today to get on Amazon and buy it.
I agree.
Okay, Harry, thank you very much. I will be talking to you in a couple of months.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Well, listen, I want to give a quick pitch here. You can go on my website and order Economy and Markets Daily, Harry Dent and Rodney Johnson's free newsletter. It's free, folks. Free. F-R-E-E. Not many things in life are free. This show is free for you to listen to and get knowledge. If we can give you knowledge, knowledge is power. It gives you an opportunity to fend off things that happen in the marketplace that you can help yourself. So we're going to take a quick break, come back with Investing Simplified. If you got a question, pick up the phone, call me 503-417-9595, toll free 877-733-1011. And we've got a caller, Joe. When we come right back, I'm going to take your call, and then we're going to do Carl's comments after that. So we'll be right back and talk to Joe on his 401k.
Hi. I'm Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and co-host of the radio program Investing Simplified. I recently left the Warren Allen Law Firm to open my own office. Professional and personable service have always been the hallmarks of my practice. I believe that this move will allow me to spend more time with my clients. For more than 37 years, it has been my privilege to assist clients with practical estate planning with wills, trusts, powers of attorney, advance directives, and other documents so that they may have peace of mind knowing that their affairs are in order. When probate becomes necessary, emotions of family members may become fragile. Having an experienced attorney that can empathize with what the client is going through makes the process much easier. My new office is conveniently located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 101, just across from Mall 205, and my phone number is 971-229-0585. That's 971-229-0585.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl now at 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money. Just before we get to Carl, we're going to take Joe. Are you on the line? Joe, we lost Joe there. So we're going to go to Carl Jepson. Carl, are you there?
I am. I'm sorry Joe fell off the line there. So, well, good morning, Chuck. And I always love following Harry because he's, a little...
Okay. Hey, Carl?
Yeah.
They do have Joe. He's ready. We're going to take him. So
very good.
Okay. Hey, Joe, are you there? No, guess not. Yeah, okay. Well, we're back to Carl.
Okay, who's on first?
Hey, you know, Carl, I think in your ad you should say conveniently located next to Chuck's office.
Well, that is true. Really next to it. That's for sure. It is very conveniently located in that regard, isn't it?
Yes.
So, well, you know, I was pondering Harry's talk, and, you know, he makes a lot of sense. He's a little scary guy sometimes, though. But and my topic today, I'm a little bit concerned that I'm adding to the negativity. But I think it's important because one of the things that the demographic thing is that we all face the fact that there are this large body of people, myself included, that are getting older, and many of us will face the prospect of having to go into some kind of care facility. And so you and I heard a lady talk the other day. I think you were at the meeting that we know who works in the healthcare and assisted care area, and she gave us some figures on what it costs for various kinds of care in the local area. And I just wanted to share with you a little bit of that. For example, in Multnomah County, the average retirement facility kind of place is $2,800 a month. That's a lot more than most people's mortgages these days. Assisted living, which is a step up, that means that there's, you know, more care, medical management, and things like that. Average cost, $4,500 a month. Memory care, and you know that those are a little more challenging because a lot of times they are a locked facility because they don't want people wandering around and going in the street and stuff. And so the average for that is, and by the way, there's much fewer places to go with memory care, $5,900 a month. Now, these are averages, so you know there's going to be some that are lower, but some that are significantly higher.
Hey, Carl, I'm going to try one more time for Joe and see if we can get Joe on the line here.
Okay.
He's been persistent to try to call back, so we appreciate him calling in.
Okay.
Yep. Joe, are you there?
Good morning. Yeah.
Good morning.
Hi. I got a question. My 401k through my work. I'm retiring next year, and I just want to know what. And my wife, when she retired, her money that she had in her 401k, they swift over to the guy that running mine. Okay, the company that's running mine. And my question is, what do we do with that money once we retire and I'm not working there anymore? Our guy says you can just leave it there, but you know, I don't know.
Well, how old are you, Joe?
63.
Okay. Okay.
I'm retiring. I'll be 64 in August.
Okay. Well, when you retire, you have the option of leaving your 401k where you're at. You also have the option of rolling over into an IRA and control it yourself. So, and sometimes a 401k, depending on your situation, depending on your age, it's better to leave it at the 401k. And sometimes, like, for example, if you're between 55 and 60, it's better to leave it there because you got advantages of pulling money out that you don't have in an IRA. But in this case, you know, usually we would recommend you taking that with you and putting that in your own IRA and controlling the money yourself.
Oh, okay. So I can. So that way, the money that my wife and I will have come that point, we should just take it out, put it into an IRA, and that way,
yeah,
I don't deal with it ourselves.
Yeah. Well, if you're working with a financial advisor, they'll usually help you do that, and they'll do what's called a rollover or a transfer, and they'll transfer the funds. That way, you pay no taxes, and the money stays sheltered until you draw it out.
Oh, okay. Then once I start drawing it out, I'll just be taxed on the amount I draw out.
That's correct. That is correct. Absolutely.
Oh, okay. So what you're saying is then, is it easier if just to leave it there or do
well,
the,
if
do
you're
IRA?
Happy, if you're happy with the investment options and they've got a lot of good options and it's a reasonable cost. Yeah, if they'll allow you to keep it there, sometimes you can get a much better deal through your 401k than you can through your own IRA. So sometimes there's a distinct advantage, and without knowing it, but I think if you sit down with your advisor, you know, we got a lot of good advisors in this town. I'm not the only one. There's a lot of good ones.
Yeah.
And I'd sit down with your advisor and talk to him, and he'll steer you straight, hopefully.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because he's a good guy. We both trust him, and he's taking care of us. So,
well, trust is a big thing, and if you trust this guy, and you're convinced that he'll do the best thing for you, I would sit down with him and lay out a roadmap what you're going to do with those funds.
Okay, cool.
Okay,
all right, well, I appreciate your help, and thank you.
Absolutely, thanks, Joe. Thanks for the call. We're going to switch back to Carl. Carl, are you there?
I am still here. I'm good. Wise. Thinking for Joe there. Well, as I mentioned, the point of my story here was that that it's very expensive. The assisted care kind of thing gets really expensive, especially if you get to the point where you're in a skilled nursing care facility and it's $350 a day or almost $11,000 a month. I mean, that's a huge amount of money. And now these are all private pay. This doesn't factor into it, you know, Medicaid, which is another topic is a lot of people think, oh, well, I'll just end up in Medicaid and that will be fine. And a lot of times here's a real stumbling block on Medicaid is there are relatively few Medicaid facilities which will take Medicaid patients or residents from the beginning. And what most places there are a number of places that allow people to come in and do what's called private pay, which are those numbers that we just talked about, for 18 months to 3 years in a facility. They basically say if you pay 18 months to 3 years on private pay, then we will keep you and we won't kick you out if you have to go on Medicaid after that. Well, you know, a lot of people think they're going to wait until they absolutely need Medicaid, and then they're going to go into a Medicaid facility. And unfortunately, those are very, very few and far between, and probably not as high quality as the ones that are private pay. So that's a scary thing. And the other thought that comes to mind is some people say, well, I'll you know, get, I have long-term care insurance that will take care of me. Well, that's true, except that, again, if you wait too long, it can be challenging. But long-term care insurance doesn't last forever. It's not like, okay, for the rest of my life, they're going to pay for my assisted care here. It usually has a duration of several years or so.
Yeah,
so,
and you can only afford so much.
Yeah. I mean, it's important to think about these things, but mostly it's important to, you know, before you have something, you know, have some kind of plan in place, at least, or some thinking as to how you want to do it, because if you have to go into it, you know, sometimes it's better to leave that house, you know, take your money out of your house, sell your house, and get into some kind of an assisted care place where you can start running the 18 months to 3 year period, so that at least you have some place to go or some place to stay, you know, later on. So, you know, and that's not very attractive to a lot of people. So anyway, that was just my comment. And I thought, though, just since that's in keeping with Harry, just a little bit on the downside, I wanted to have a couple of reflections on aging or growing older, as they say, that were sent to me by one of our favorite people in the world. And these are kind of little funny little things. But one was my goal for 2016 was to lose just 10 pounds. Only 15 to go. How to prepare tofu. One, throw it in the trash. Two, grill some meat. I like that one. Sorry, you tofu folks. And then I don't mean to brag, but I finished my 14-day diet food in 3 hours and 20 minutes. So, and finally, senility has been a smooth transition for me. So anyway, some comments on aging that, you know, may or may not be true for anyone. But so that's Carl's comments.
Well, great, Carl. We got Kevin holding on the line, too. We're going to take a quick break and come back to Kevin to wrap up the show. And, you know, you talked about a scary thing about long-term care. Another scary thing is April 15th when you got to have those stupid taxes done. And we're going to talk to Kevin about that. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com. 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask Kevin Stege, CPA and shareholder of the Baker Colson CPA firm, that tax question that's been keeping you up at night. You can call Kevin 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's the CPA with the tax answers, Kevin Stege.
Well, hello. Are we on?
Hello, Kevin. How you doing?
I am good. Do we still have Carl on the line here, or is he just...
We still have Carl on the line, I think.
Oh, very good. Well, I just, we've talked about market crashes, long-term care options, layoffs at Intel, senility, now taxes, and I guess after all this down news, as Kelsey Grammer said, and that, we all have the auspice of death hanging over us, too.
Well, let's stick to the taxes.
All right. Sounds good. And after listening to this show, hopefully folks can head out into a beautiful sunny day and enjoy the day and maybe just ponder some of these things in their heart and enjoy the time we have. So, well, today on the Tax Investigator, I am going to finish my very brief comment on this tax court case on alimony. And, Carl, I was just wondering if you were still around, because this is where as I said before, the devil is in the details. And I know we have a very short time to wrap this up, so I will cut to the chase. This is a tax court case where, first off, alimony is deductible to the person who pays it, and it is taxable to the person who receives it. And that's pretty well just a standard issue tax law right there. But we had a court case where a person deducted the alimony that they paid, but the tax court said, nope, you don't get it. And I'm thinking, that's interesting. I wonder what the circumstances are. And one of the things that is required in alimony for it to be alimony is that the payments, alimony payments, must cease upon the death of the recipient. So when the person, your ex, passes away, if your payments stop, then that is part of what defines a payment being alimony. Well, in this case, the taxpayer got behind on his or her alimony payments, and eventually the next year they caught up all of their past due spousal support payments, their alimony, and then deducted them on the tax return. And the tax court got the big Dikembe Mutombo finger out and went, and shook it in their face and said, you don't get that because those payments did not cease upon the death of the recipient. Because even if that spouse had died, you still would have had to have paid those past due alimony payments to catch up. And so that is just an interesting look into how the devil's in the details, and in this case, it happens to be the timing of the payment. Same money went out, it just was later, and so that the person did not get the deduction. So there's our lesson for the day on the tax investigator.
You know, that's an interesting case, because the alimony, maybe the moral of the story is don't get behind on your alimony payment.
That is.
Keep paying them until till you die, I guess. But until your spouse dies anyway. What happens is if you get behind, that arrearage becomes a judgment against you. So it's
exactly.
A debt. So they won't let you, deduct the repayment of the debt, I think, is what's happening here.
Yep. So that's a tough lesson to learn, but I guess we all have to learn some of those in life, but that's not one I would want to be on that side. So I'm curious why we have a law where two people who are usually at loggerheads with each other, where one of them benefits upon the death of the other. That seems a little, maybe not a good situation.
It sounds like a plot for a good TV show.
Exactly right.
Yeah, I kind of thought that's where you were heading with this, that the guy killed his spouse and then he tried to write off the deductions for the payments he gave to her.
Well, that's a little deeper planning, I think.
Carl.
That's exactly right. Better call Carl behind that closed door room. So.
Well, Kevin, yeah. I just want to know, is your office open 24/7 for the next couple of days?
Oh, we try to start winding down about now and try to do things decently in order. So, we've got a few returns to get out, and those clients of mine who are listening to me talk, I'm working on your stuff right after I hang up, so don't you worry. But we don't have too many of those, so we try to keep normal hours. And, we're open a little later, but not too bad.
Well, I don't mind saying, Kevin, I appreciate it. Last night at 8 o'clock, you and I finishing mine.
Well,
so I appreciate that.
Absolutely, Chuck. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, and I was glad to get that check in the mail.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we've got about 30 seconds, guys. So how does somebody get a hold of you, Kevin?
We are at baker-colson.com, and our phone number is 503-666-5569 if you want an extension.
And Carl?
My telephone number is 971-229-0585.
Okay, we're at pfgwm.com. See you all next week. We'll talk to you on Investing Simplified. Have a great week. It's going to be beautiful out there.
you can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show was brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000, or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. How often do you have a checkup? Annually? Only when you're not feeling your best? Or are you one who waits until there is an emergency condition? High blood pressure, rapid pulse, or sleepless nights could be the result of your investment portfolio or no estate plan. But there is a specialist ready to offer you a checkup on your financial health.
Paging Dr. Price. Paging Dr. Price.
Chuck Price, the financial doctor and author of Investing Simplified, is offering you a free financial checkup. Whether you're asking for a second opinion, a complete financial physical, or investment stress test, Chuck Price, the financial doctor, can help diagnose your money ailments and prescribe a prudent path towards healthy investments and peace of mind. Call 503-253-3000 to schedule your financial checkup or on the web at pfgwm.com. That's pfgwm.com. You'll feel better.
A lot can happen in an hour. We're here to make sure you don't miss a thing.
Stay connected with FM News 101.
KXL FM, Portland.
And KXL.com.